Hello and welcome. I'm Tom Heck, president and founder of the International Association of Teamwork Facilitators. Today is Thursday, June 17th, 2010. It is 1:01 p.m. Eastern, and you have dialed in to the monthly visiting faculty member call, and our guest today is Dr. Lance Secretan, and we're going to be introducing him a little bit more here in just a moment, but I did want to mention that today's call does include the opportunity to view a web interface. We call it a participant dashboard. And so you can see the participant dashboard through the link that was sent to you when you dialed into, were given the number and PIN for today's call. And that participant dashboard allows you to send messages type in messages that I can see, and I can read these off and at the right time, and you can write questions or comments to myself or Lance. And then we're also going to be able to do a polling feature today. So just out of curiosity, let's do a quick test of the polling. Hit your one key if you are logged into the participant dashboard and can see that, the one key on your phone, because we might be doing some polls here today with Lance as we go through. Oh, very good. Okay, so virtually everyone here today can see that. Very good. So a little bit about the IATF. All of our work here at the IATF is designed to do one thing, grow inspired teams. Now, if you're wondering why I'm so excited to have Lance here, is because Lance is all about bringing inspiration into the work environment, which is delightful. So a little bit about Lance. Dr. Lance Secretan is authored many books, and his latest is the one that we're going to be talking about today. The title is The Spark, The Flame, and The Torch: Inspire Self, Inspire Others, and Inspire the World. This is a new book, and you can find out more about it right now if you decide to log into his website. And it's www.secretan.com, and it's S-E-C-R-E-T-A-N. And Lance has been identified as one of the world's top ranked and top five leadership speakers in America. He is one of the Fortune's most admired companies. He works with top Fortune companies. He's written a number of books, as I said. The last one that we actually, the one just before this one is entitled One, The Art of and Practice of Conscious Leadership. And so, Lance, we could go on and on about all the things that you bring to the table and why you're here today, but I want to make sure that we go ahead and start, because we've got a lot of ground to cover. So let's maybe start here. Can you help us understand why now? Why are we talking about inspiration in the workplace when things are so hard, when so many people are and organizations are essentially in survival mode as we're in a tough economy?
Well, I think that inspiration has been something that I have been working with for 30 years. Some traction. We've been pretty happy with what we've been able to achieve, and we've done a lot of good work. But it does puzzle me that so many organizations continue to work under misconceptions about what works. And so we have the Great Recession, you know, and that's really the sum of our knowledge and our work of other people and the way we've been running things. So I've been working on this book for 7 years, so it was long before that happened, but I could see what was going on. I was unhappy with what I saw in organizations. And let me just tell you quickly, you know, I don't think mission statements make any sense. I don't think performance appraisals make any sense. I think coaching is a broken kind of industry. I think that psychometric profiling is kind of redundant. I think that fear is endemic in our workplace. So all of these things to me are evidence of a broken system. And so what I wanted to do was to write a book that says, let's start with a fresh page. Let's not tinker and tweak things, but let's start with a fresh look at what would you do if you were to create an awesome organization of any kind, whether we're talking a country or a city or a company or a hospital or a prison or a school, whatever. let's talk about how we build something that's really inspiring. And that's what the book is about.
So it's interesting. I know that you mentioned this sort of the dark era of leadership. And in your mind, when you look around at the dark era, sort of this, the old school style of leadership, the style of leadership that has gotten us into a place where we have a recession and all the news leading up to it and the things that are being revealed, it seems like, daily about how people have led, what characterizes that? How, in other words, we're going to be talking today about a new style of leadership. What defines the old way of leading, to kind of give us a comparison contrast?
Well, let me give you a good example. I'll sort of start in the middle. The flame part of the book describes how we go out into the world and change it and inspire other people. And we do that using something we call the Castle Principles. Now, the Castle Principles is something we discovered by asking the question you just asked. What is it that leaders or followers do not like about their leaders? And here's the summary. They don't like cowards. They don't like people who are phony. They don't like people who are selfish and serve themselves. And they don't like people who rule with fear or who lie or who are incompetent. Now, that is a list of six things that we found in our research that followers were tired of. They're just fed up with leaders that do that. And we see, by the way, a lot of it. Now, if we were to take those six ideas and reverse them, then we would end up with something that looks like this: courage, authenticity, service, truthfulness, love, and effectiveness. Now, those six words are an acronym for CASEL. And so how do we inspire the world? We learn to be courageous, authentic, serve others, tell the truth, loving, word we don't use, by the way, much in the business world, and effective. In the book, for example, it's full of lots of stories, and one of the stories I tell in the section about love is that, you know, we have this funny Western Anglo-Saxon hang-up about love, and we can't actually say to each other that we love each other, and we're worried about harassment and human resource policy and heaven knows what all. But, you know, I tell the story about Charlie Brown, who was a pilot that I met. He sadly died last year, but he was a World War I fighter pilot. And the story is quite long, but I'll make it short. He's on a bombing raid in World War II, flew off from the English coast over to Germany to bomb a aircraft manufacturing plant. And along his way, he bumps into eight fighter pilots from the German Air Force, and he gets terribly ripped up, loses the tail of his plane, the front end of his plane, half his wing is shot off, one engine is dead, and he's unconscious. All his crew, seven members, are wounded in one way or another, and one or two of them were killed. And he goes unconscious. He's flying his plane upside down, 1,000 feet over the ground, and he wakes up out of his unconsciousness and rights the plane and tries to climb again. And on the ground, refueling, is Franz Stigler, who is a German pilot, fighter pilot, and he sees this plane coming across the woods where he's refueling upside down, and he scrambles into his plane because he's already shut down two planes that day. And if he shoots down three in a day, he'll get the Iron Cross, which is the highest honor you can get in the German Air Force. So he scrambles into his plane, heads up after Charlie Brown to bring him down. And as he gets up to him, he realizes what terrible shape this plane is in. And as he gets closer, he tries to line up behind him, because that's where you would take a plane down, if you could. And he sees that the gunner, tail gunner, is dead. And then he flies up across the top of the plane and sees that everybody else is in a terrible state of wounded condition. And so he decides not to shoot the plane, and he guides the plane safely across to the coastline of Europe and then sends Charlie Brown on his own way across to England, where he lands safely. Later, 50 years later, they met. They discovered each other. And Charlie Brown said, "Why didn't you kill me?" And here's the punchline. Franz Stigler said, "I only shoot planes. I never shoot people. And when I saw all of the people, I couldn't shoot them." Now, when you think about what's wrong with business today, that's exactly what's wrong with business today. We can fire 500 people, but I'm telling you, if you had to sit down with every single one of those 500 and tell them face to face, "You're done, you're through," you couldn't do it. You'd be in the washroom throwing up. Nobody can do that systematically. It's very easy to shoot planes and very hard to shoot people. And so when we change the whole way we think about this and look at people as the reality of our business, we reframe everything. Now, that's just one example in one chapter, but it's typical of the stories I tell in the book about the way we need to rethink some of the things we do.
So when you, after writing so many books, Lance, one of the things that surprises me, I mean, how many books have you written?
This is number 15. Not that many. Lots of people have written more books than that.
Okay. Well, and yet you're still in the place where you're my understanding is with this book is that you've pulled in I guess you were inspired to bring in a lot of components that you had sort of talked about in previous books, but have given a more complete how-to. Is that right? Is this like
yes,
a
and really an up-to-date version of some of those thoughts and ideas, and not only that, but integrating them into one theory.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing is that, you know, 14 sort of standalone books that all have different ideas and thoughts in them is one thing, but putting it together as I now can do, because I've looked back and thought, you know, this really works. We've had some amazing results with some great organizations, and I think I'm really onto something. I see it working. It's almost like duck soup. If you do this, this is going to happen. If you do this, you build inspiring organizations, and inspired people are more effective. I just talked to somebody 20 minutes ago who said, you know, they were in the business of writing press releases and, you know, inspiring messages to the media. If you've got a dysfunctional team where everybody's yelling at each other, people are unhappy, some people don't even talk to each other, you're ruling with fear, they're totally demoralized and they're worried about whether they're safe and so on. And now you say, now, go and write a really inspiring press release. It's impossible. But if everybody's really inspired and we say, let's write a really inspiring press release, it's a whole lot easier. So therefore, it translates, as you can see, into high performance and meaningful work.
Well, let's do this. Let's maybe start at the beginning of there's three major components to your book. It's laid out in the title, the spark, the flame, and the torch. Let's start with the spark. What is that? Is the book divided into three sections?
Yeah, it is. And essentially, the general idea here, you see, is that it's about inspiration, as I say, because we're yearning for that. All of us want more inspiration from everything. We're pretty dejected about a lot of stuff. And quite honestly, all the things that we thought were safe are turning out not to be. So we thought that the church was a solid place, and it turns out not to be safe. We thought that politics was safe, and it turns out not to be safe. So what are we going to be left with? And we are left with business, and it's looking kind of wonky too. So we need to change. We know that model is the most powerful institution on the planet. We need to turn it around so that it becomes a really, truly inspiring model. In other words, an institution that can solidly and positively change the world. Let me give you an example. Walmart employs around 2 million employees. And Manpower, the company I used to run, has about 4.5 million employees. McDonald's, Siemens, Hohan Industries, Deutsche Post, they each have 500,000. So between those six companies, there are 10 million people employed. 150 million nearly people shop every single day at Walmart. If we could change those six companies and make them more inspiring, we'd change the world. So what we need to really understand is we're not just making money and making shareholders richer, which, you know, is a good thing too. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But that's not the real purpose of what we're about. What we're trying to do is change the world, and we're trying to create a more inspiring world than the one we have. And business is our lever if we do it well. And so the spark is really about, so how does this all go? Well, first I have to be inspired. I can't ask other people to be inspired if I haven't got it in me. You can't give what you don't have. So I need to inspire myself first. So the spark is about how we do that. And I'll just skim across the middle. The flame is how we then go out into the world and inspire others. And the torch is how we create a legacy, pass it on, pay it forward, coach, teach, mentor, guide, lead, all those things. So back to the spark. We do five things in order to ignite our own spark. One, we understand why we're here on a planet, our destiny. Secondly, we understand what our character is, how we want to be known in the world. When somebody, when it's all over, and somebody chisels your epitaph, Tom, in a headstone, what are they going to say? Tom was what? What kind of person were you? That's your character. And lastly, thirdly, I should say, is your calling. We need to know what our calling is. So many people are in places that are not inspiring for them, both work-wise but also skill-wise. Amazing how people suppress gifts and talents that they have, and how strange it is that we can't release those and play them at work. You know, we can't die with our music inside us still. The fourth thing is that we become inspired ourselves by building inspiring relationships, and there are, we can distill that into practical steps. There are some real sciences to that and some technologies to that. And we introduce something called Five Dynamics, which is a wonderful profile that we've discovered, which is a replacement and something that supersedes all the other kind of profiling instruments. In a nutshell, if you can learn someone else's learning style and you know your own, you can connect up with them in ways that you could never have done before, and as a result have an inspiring dialogue and relationship with them that will lead to inspiration for you, for them too, but for you. And lastly, we need a dream. That's where I get into the mission, vision, and values thing, because all that I think is totally redundant and boring. Every great achievement has a dream powering it. As you know, Tom, I ski a lot, and I live in the Rockies, and I ski every day in the winter. And I know a lot of athletes that went to the Olympics last year. Every single one of them had a dream. You don't get to the Olympics if you don't have a dream. You don't actually do anything that's marvelous or amazing unless you have a dream. Organizations need dreams, and we need dreams. So there's a whole process in the book about how do we create a dream. So that's the spark. Those five steps ignite us and ignite the spark and enable us then to start our work about inspiring others.
Let's try this. Just based on those three criteria that you just outlined, the sort of the destiny, character, and calling,
right.
I'd like to do just three quick surveys, three quick polls. And so for everyone listening, here's what we're going to do. We're going to use keys 1 through 5, and I just want you to rate yourself. And we're going to do these three quick polls. And I would just like – and you'll everyone on the call, if you're logged into the participant dashboard, you'll be able to see the results of this just so we can kind of see where we are, you know, people who are on this call. So on a scale of 1 to 5, maybe, Lance, you can help me language this. 1 being low, 5 being higher, the best. Where do you feel right now you are in understanding your own destiny? Is that a good question, Lance?
Yeah, it is. And destiny explains why you're here on this planet. What's the big picture? How will the planet be different and changed as a result of your being here? What is your role here?
So rate yourself on your ability, where you stand right now with your, how you connect with that, whether you, so 1 would be you're not connected with that right now at all, or very minimally, and 5 is you're on top of it. You are so connected with this feeling of destiny. And so let's see where people place themselves. Wow, we're right all over the board here, and it looks like most people, Lance, are in the three to four arena. So does that tell you, I mean, is this normal for you to see, Lance?
Yes, absolutely. And remember what we're saying here. If we don't really know why we're here on this planet, what's the purpose of our life, how are we going to make the world different, what's the meaning of what we do, not just making widgets and making profits and making them numbers and doing the metrics and going to work every day and all that, beyond that, what is the great thing that you're doing? If we don't know that, then how can we be exciting and inspiring for other people? How can we build organizations that are amazing? We need to know that. That's where we start. And when we know that, by the way, when we know those three pieces, destiny, cause, and calling, or destiny, character, and calling, which we think of as why we do, because it explains why am I here, how will I be, and what will I do. So we call it a why we do for shorthand. When you know that, it is amazingly liberating and extremely exciting. So what happens is that you become inspired internally. And then what happens is that when you're in the presence of a person who has that inner awareness and knowing, mm-hmm. you're inspired because you can see it. It radiates from them.
So here's always the question is, how do you get to the place where you have this this inner feeling, this inner knowing that is because you're right, when I'm in the presence of someone who is there, it's very different than being with someone who's has spent little or no time exploring that arena.
And imagine if you have a company like that, that where everybody's done it. Imagine if you have a team like that, that where everybody's done it, or even a family, or even some a group that runs a city or a country. You know, when you have that awareness and knowledge, it becomes a totally, as you say, a totally different thing. The answer to how do you do it? Buy the book. It's all in there.
Now, what would you say to somebody who says, hey, you know, Lance, I've got a business to run. You know, I've got bills to pay. I got payroll. And you're asking me to take my staff out for a day or however long or, you know, to read this book when, you know, I've got these, this is the sort of the real, the sense that I get on my end when I'm talking with different business leaders or team leaders is that, you know, God, these are great things. These are nice things. And boy, I wish the economy was different and I had time to do it. What would you say to somebody who says, maybe when the economy improves, I'll start investing in this?
Well, I mean, I hope they would start by just simply buying a book. I mean, that's not a big investment, and it's not demanding them to change. Frankly, I defy anybody to read that book and not change, because I think that it will move them to the place where they say, damn, I have to do that. Just let me tell you one story. You know, with the Five Dynamics Profile, which is part of how we become inspired, there's a college in California where the professors learned this system and learned their learning styles. This is in a college where the graduation rates were 28%. They were in an economically and ethnically challenged neighborhood, very tough neighborhood, and 28% was what they had achieved. Now, in the next four-month semester, that figure changed from 28% to 82%. Now, if I tell you, look, read the book and do the things that it says there because this is what's going to happen, what's not to love?
And so what got them to the place where they said we've got to do something? Was there a catastrophe or?
No, they just thought this is interesting. This five dynamic stuff. I mean, that makes sense to me. This whole idea of understanding the learning styles and energies of people. If I knew that better, could connect with people better. I mean, after all, I've got students in my classroom who have different learning styles, and here I am teaching with one learning style. If I could adapt my teaching to fit their different learning style and therefore be much more precise, in other words, hit the target with every single one of them, because and it obviously requires a different system with each of them, but I can learn how to do that, and if I can do that, I can transform the whole experience of learning, make it exciting and inspiring for them, and they'll be inclined, therefore, not to goof up, but to graduate.
Okay, so let's do another quick poll here. I want to see where people rate themselves on character. How should we language this? On a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being low, 5 being highest or best, would it be appropriate to say rate yourself on how on the character that you are right now, the level of, is it integrity? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, the qualities that you want to be known as. I mean, in my case, my character statement is to be known as a loving and inspiring person. This is how I want people to know me, and therefore I want to live that way. Now, it's not easy. I am constantly off track. I fall off the wagon regularly. People call me on it all the time, and it's something that I have to work on because I'm not always a loving person. But I want, in the end, to live my life as a loving and inspiring person. And, you know, the measurement is on a scale of 0 to 10 or 0 to 5 in your case, how close are you to that ideal?
Very good. Okay, so rate yourself right now, everyone. Rate yourself on how close you are to living that as best you can on a regular basis. Wow, okay. This is very, now if you can't see the results, refresh your page. I see that there was a few people who had some difficulty viewing the results here. So Lance, right now the people are either rating themselves as a 3 or a 4, which I find very interesting.
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead, Lance.
I would say that's it would be interesting to go through an experience with everybody on the line here, because I think we quite often overestimate ourselves in this area. You know, I like to think of myself as a loving and inspiring people, but I tell you, I could find a lot of people who would disagree with me. So, you know, I think that we have to be really careful about how highly we value ourselves, given the fact that, you know, this is quite a challenging thing for us to live every day. We're not asking what is our intention. It's my intention to be loving and inspiring. What we're asking here is, what actually happens? Are you? Because, you know, in most organizations, and loving and inspiring is my choice. That doesn't have to be everybody else's. But, you know, I send emails that are not inspiring. I make conversations in meetings that are not inspiring. There are moments, even with my wife, where I'm not as loving as I know I want to be. And I honor and respect her more than anybody else on the planet.
You know, this, I think of this, I've got a 6-year-old daughter and an 11-year-old son, and both of my children are great teachers for me in this arena because, you know, going back to the character piece, Lance, is what do I want to be known for? And
right.
Then there's the, what am I actually doing? You know,
right.
It's like my daughter yesterday wanted me to come. Last summer, I was inspired to sew up a teepee. And so my daughter came running up yesterday and said, Daddy, Daddy, you got to see this giant snail and its beautiful shell that's on the teepee. And I said, Liza, I'm getting ready to do this program. I got to do this, and this. And so she just kind of walked away. She didn't, you know, give me a hard time. She just came in with her excitement and then walked away.
Right.
And then it was in her walking away that I thought at this moment, I said, okay, this is where the doing aspect comes in, isn't it?
Yes.
My intention is to be a loving father and to be known like that. And then there's the time when my daughter walks in and says, Daddy, let me show you something important.
Right.
And I say, well, I'm doing this. I don't have time for that.
Harry Chapin, do you remember him?
Yes.
Harry Chapin had a wonderful song about that. It was called Roses Are Red.
Well, and then, you know, there's the Cats in the Cradle.
That's,
you know,
right.
Yeah. So there's, but this is where the sort of the rubber meets the road, it seems, what you're talking about. So, all right, so for our, and we're going to move on here to in a moment to part two, the spark of the book that you talk about. So we've talked about, I'm sorry, the flame. So the spark ignites the flame. So, but before we do that, let's just do a quick one more quick poll, and that is the doingness. Why is that? The why we're here?
No, that's the last part is the calling. So the question
is,
you know, what are our gifts, and are we using them to serve? Now, you know, many people would say, well, you know, if I won the lottery, I'd be a guitar player or a rock singer or a, you know, whatever. And they haven't won the lottery, so they're not doing that. So the question is, well, why aren't you? Because if that's what your heart calls you to do, that's what you should be doing. And of course it means that, you know, you're going to have some disruption because you've got to pay mortgages and you've got kids going to school and all the rest of it, and you have to have your eye on that ball. But what's going to happen? Are you going to live the whole of your life not practicing the gifts that you were born with and that you would like to enhance? My wife, for example, right now is, right as we speak, she's at art class because she's newly discovered that she has artistic talent and she is amazing. And these gifts, I mean, here she is in her 50s and she's never done this before in her whole life, and she's producing brilliant pieces of art. With a good teacher and so on, it's her time in her life to say, damn, this is my calling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm quite sure that even at this late stage, it's possible for her to become a commercial artist.
So in your estimation, the distinction that I'm drawing here is that the why we're here, our purpose, is different than our calling. Is that right?
Because correct. Yes. Why is how we're going to change the world. The calling is what gifts do we have that we're going to use to serve.
And can that change? Do you see that changing with time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my gifts are writing and teaching and speaking, and I use this to lead and serve others.
Mm-hmm. So this is the part that we have to pay attention to. Am I using my gifts right now and following my calling? Because sometimes, you know, especially for a younger generation, they say, is it seven careers on average for someone in the millennial generation? That's a way to express their gifts, why they're here, so they're following their calling.
So the question is, are you doing the work you love, and are you following your calling, the things that you're passionate about? Are you able to do those freely and perfectly every day?
So let's do that. Rate yourself 1 to 5. Where do you stand? 5 is highest and best. You're just, you know, you're doing that thing. And 1 would be you're not anywhere really close to following your calling, and you would very much like to move closer to the 5. Okay, and I did see, by the way, that someone else was having trouble seeing the results of the straw polls. Hit just refresh your page. That should do it, generally.
Okay, one of the things that's fascinating for me, Tom, is that work is a word that was first used in the English language in the 1600s. Before that, we never even used the word. It was an invention, a modern invention. We didn't go to work. There wasn't such a thing as work. Work, which meant hunting or making something, was what you did every day anyway. I mean, you did that just to eat. So, you know, one of the ways of looking at one's calling is, well, what would it look like if you didn't think of it as work? You know, I don't think of what I do as work. I just love what I do, and therefore I'd do it if you didn't pay me to do it. So that's what
I
mean.
Yes, I love that. I have a friend who just recently retired as a college professor. And now, when I say recently, with this last graduation this spring, right? And after 30 years of teaching at a university, he's now exploring his next calling and what that means and how he can, because he's not done. I see him as a relatively young person, but this is a big question that he's grappling with.
Right.
Because he recognizes that he could play golf every day, which he likes, but it's not his calling. It's more of a hobby. So, I mean, would he love golf? Maybe he loves it. He loves to play, but it's not his calling.
Yeah.
And so he's exploring that.
Right.
Well, so we see the results of the poll here. Is that we actually have mostly threes and fours, which is fantastic. There's a couple in the twos, nobody at one, and then a couple at the other end at five. So, Lance, let's move on to the part two in the book where you talk about the flame. And maybe you can make the segue from the spark to the flame. Why this section?
Well, you see, once we become inspired, the spark, then we're able to be inspiring. You can't be inspiring if you're not inspired. That's really hard. I mean, you can fake it for a bit, but it's very, very hard. It drains energy. And essentially, what other people experience from an inspiring person is the fact that they are inspired. And therefore, you know, we go through the spark first to make sure we got that piece working properly, and then we can move on to, okay, now let's inspire the world. And that one's really quite simple to describe, as I referred to it earlier. We need then to do whatever we're doing with other people in a way that's courageous. We lack that, you know, in our lives. Authentic. We need to be straight up. I mean, the whole BP thing that we've been seeing in the Gulf, part of the problem here is a lack of authenticity. People have been straight up right from the beginning. It would have been a whole lot easier and clearer and more straightforward to deal with. BP is one of my clients, so I know something about, you know, how they work and what goes on, and I'm amazed at what's been happening. But people want authenticity. You can see how differently this would have played out if we had been more authentic. Service. People want to be served and not served for themselves. So I often use examples like the wireless phone industry, for example. Now, I don't know about you, but You know, I can't understand my plan. I don't know when I'm over or under on my minutes. It drives me crazy. I'm fussing about at the end of the month wondering whether I'm going to have an extra billing on my account. I'm locked into contracts. I mean, the whole thing is just such an irritation. And that is about serving oneself, you know, the company in this case, rather than serving a customer. What I would love is them to say, look, pay me $150 a month and don't look at anything. That covers everything, nothing to worry about. If you have anything you want to know, just call us. That would be a proper relationship, which would be serving the customer. I don't know why they don't do that, but that's just one example. Or, you know, take the airline industry as another example. I mean, total, endless frustration. Why do I have to live with this? What is the issue going on here? Why not just serve customers? And so on. So, you know, everybody wants it. Starbucks figured it out. They're doing it. Other airlines like Southwest figured out they're doing it. Disney's figured it out they're doing it. Some people get it. Some people don't. But leaders are here to serve, and particularly to serve their followers. So truthfulness, truth-telling, you know, I could play a game with you online, but it would be interesting to see how much we think we tell the truth and how much we actually tell the truth, because I can guarantee you there's a big difference. Well, why don't we do this? Let's, if we're ready for a poll.
Yes, let's do that.
Let's do a little poll here. On a 1 to 5, please answer this question. I always tell the truth.
5 being?
You choose the scale.
Okay.
0 is no, obviously, and 5 would be yes, so 0 to 5.
Okay.
Or 1 to 5.
One to five, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, and when you say always, that means?
Well, just answer the question.
My wife says, Tom, does this dress look nice on me? And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, no.
Mm-hmm.
Then I say, yes, I'm not being truthful.
Right.
Okay.
So
good.
We have everything from 1 to 5 here. Now, let's pick the middle number. Let's say 3. Now,
yeah.
What does a 3 mean? I always tell the truth. What does that mean? Half the time I always tell the truth? You can't always do something sometimes. So you see, the only answer to this question is 1, if 1 is 0. And 5 is impossible. Nobody always tells the truth. Not even Mother Teresa always told the truth. So I give you this little game here because I want to point out how fast and loose we are with the truth. It's not that we're bad people. It's just that we have devalued the currency of truth, and we think it's okay to say, I always tell the truth, when in reality that's not true. And that's paradoxical. Or we say, I always tell the truth nearly all the time. Well, that's impossible. Mathematically, that doesn't work out. So there's only one answer. If everybody answered 1 on this poll, then we would be all truthful. And I'm not saying we're bad. I'm saying this is the way life is. But if we just turn the volume up a little bit on our standards around truth-telling, we would be inspiring, because that's what people want. I mean, what do we want from our politicians? We want politicians that tell the truth.
How do you coach someone, Lance, when the truth is hard or uncomfortable?
Well, I tell a story in the book about this. I mean, there's a big piece about the healthcare industry. We do not tell the truth in the healthcare business, and roughly 1 million people are dying every year in America's healthcare system. This is unnecessary deaths where people are killed. I don't mean just people dying. I mean they are being killed by the system. Wrong medications, wrong surgeries, wrong procedures, wrong prescriptions, and so on. Mistakes. And 1 million people are dying. 300,000 actually reported, 350,000 actually, but only 30% of the incidents are reported, so we're estimating that it's 3 times as bad as that. Now, what happens? Well, lawsuits, risk management, you know, gigantic legal processes, tort, and all the rest of it, and you know what's going on in our healthcare industry with the side issues of expense and so on. So now, what would happen if we tell the truth? Well, of course, the first thing the lawyers say is, well, we'd be sued from here to kingdom come. So, you know, we can't do that. Well, that is simply not true. And for instance, at the University of Michigan, Richard Boothman, who's the chief risk officer there, he has said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to change the game completely. If we make a mistake, we're going to own up and tell you the truth. Hmm. And we'll pay fair compensation, and we won't go to court. If you come after us and try and sue us for something we don't think we've done, we're going to fight you right to the bitter end, and you probably won't win. Now, tort lawyers have got a revision, therefore, of how they expect to deal with the University of Michigan healthcare system. They know that if they go and sue them, you better cinch up your saddle because this is going to be a long ride. But they also know that if you've got a legitimate case, you're going to settle quickly and it's going to be over fast and everybody's going to be okay. Now, that's what happens when you tell the truth. And let me tell you that in 6 years, the University of Michigan, practicing this system, has dropped their payments and the cases outstanding by 3/4.
Wow.
So that's what happens
amazing.
When you tell the truth. I mean, the idea that you think you can get into trouble by telling the truth is actually the exact opposite. If you tell the truth, people will, I mean, if BP had told the truth right from the get-go, I don't think we'd be so mad. We wouldn't be happy, but we wouldn't be so mad. Now we're really ticked off, and it's costing them enormous amounts of money now, $20 billion just for set aside for payments, for instance, and that's only the beginning of it.
Hmm. So I know we're running through the castle principles, so courage, authenticity, service, truthfulness, and
yep.
then you have love.
I talked about love earlier when I talked about Charlie Brown and the pilot. And then effectiveness. I mean, honestly, we need to do things that are effective. Imagine this for a moment. The tobacco industry could have easily said to people 50 years ago, excuse me, tobacco will kill you, but enjoy our cigarettes because they're better than anybody else's. It wouldn't have made any difference at all to their sales, but it would have saved them $260 billion in lawsuits. Because they would have said, hey, we told you right from the get-go this is going to kill you. What are you suing us now for?
It's connected to truthfulness. That
yes.
Sort of,
and effectiveness. Yeah, and effectiveness, too. I mean, they're all linked, of course. We're artificially separating them. But, you know, if you want to run an organization that's effective, then practice the Castle Principles.
Mm-hmm. When it comes time, and I'm looking, I want to make sure that we have opportunities for people to ask questions or
sure.
to, if you need something clarified. And I'm going to ask you to start, everyone to start thinking about a hard question that you want to ask Lance about.
Or an easy
how
one.
To get these going. Or anyway. Yeah, any easy question, hard question. But because there's, I recognize, and so do you, Lance, that people are going to leave this call and they have, you know, quote, the real world to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I love about your work is that you've worked in, quote, the real world. And,
absolutely.
And your major, you work with some of the largest organizations in the world who are exploring this, learning how to incorporate this. And then you're also working with, you know, school systems. I know that there was a school system in Georgia.
Right.
That ordered how many books?
800.
Okay,
yeah.
A school system in Georgia is ordering 800 books because of this book, The Spark, the Flame, and the Torch, because they recognize, they see the potential of transformation of an organization. And where does that start? It starts with the teacher in the classroom and from that place. But and this is what I like about your work is that you say how to, you know, nice to know, but if everyone here is on this call, you want to know how to do this with yourself and step by step, get this book.
And just a footnote on the Georgia story, the reason they bought 800 books is because what I'm writing about in this book is what they've been doing for 6 years. I've been coaching them over that time, and they went from the 800th school district in the country to the 200th school district in the country. On the 1,000, you know, best school districts in America list. They are the 13th largest school district in America, and they will next year probably be in the top 100 in the whole country using the principles in this book.
Wow. All right. So this is what's possible. If you're listening to this and you think that there's a possibility here, this is why I'm so excited to have Lance here. Okay, so Lance, part three, the flame lights the torch. So we've talked about the spark and then
right.
the flame, and now we're at the torch. Why? What is this section about?
We don't have enough time to get into this one in detail, but essentially it looks like this. There are three things that we typically do that can explain everything that gets done in the world. Mastery, chemistry, and delivery. We either So we have to do something well. We have to do it in a way that works with people and relates well with people, chemistry. And we have to do it in a way that serves others, delivery. Now, we can't just wake up in the morning and make that up. You know, we can't say, okay, now I need to be more masterful today, because you can't just get there from here. So we have to do something called an accelerator. There are three accelerators. The mastery, chemistry, and delivery are called primary values. The accelerators are learning, empathizing, and listening. If you want more mastery, then you need to learn something. If you want more chemistry, then you need to empathize. If you need to deliver more effectively to others, to serve their needs, in other words, you need to listen more in order to know what those needs are. So, now subtract the one number from the other, so subtract mastery from learning, and you end up with a number called the vector. And the vector is either negative or positive. And if I'm going too fast, then you know, need to read the book to slow it all down. But here's the thing that is the bottom line. If you know what your vector is, you know whether you're growing or declining. So, for example, if you have a 10 in mastery and a 7 in learning, what this is telling you is your mastery is fabulous, but it's not going to be, because your learning is not sufficient to maintain that standard of mastery. And that's telling you you need to invest in learning so that the learning is now commensurate with the mastery you're seeking. If, on the other hand, you say the mastery is 7 and the learning is 10, then you would have a positive vector of 3, which means you know that the mastery is already not 10 and that you need to work on it, and you're already paying attention to the learning, which will affect the mastery in the future. So now you can see that what you have is actually a revolutionary model for looking at things like coaching. When you're coaching and have a coaching relationship, you say to someone, what kind of mastery are you looking for? And they'll say, well, I want a 9 or a 10. Say, okay, so what do you think you need to learn in order to get there? You see how that works?
Yeah.
In a performance appraisal, we typically look at mastery, and that's all we say. Oh, very good, you are a 10 in mastery. We check that off. But we actually need to know a lot more than that. Where are you in learning, and do you have a positive or negative vector? Because that's going to tell me whether you're going to grow or not in the future. And that I'm really interested in. And so should you be. Now, it's not that you're right or wrong when you do these things, but rather that's the way we can start to measure the dynamic of our relationship. And that's how we coach, teach, grow, mentor, pay it forward, lead, create a legacy, and so on. It's a master system for doing all of those things. So that's what the torch is all about.
I love it. Okay, so a question came in here. And by the way, let's do this. If you have a question for Lance that you'd like to ask, and I can hand you the mic and everyone will be able to hear you, you'll get on the recording, hit your one key, and then I'll hand the mic to you, virtually hand the mic to you. And Lance, I do want to tee this up for the end. You have something called a pledge to inspire, and we're going to wrap up the call with that. And also, by the way, again, if you want to learn more about Lance's work, go to secretan.com, S-E-C-R-E-T-A-N, secretan.com. So a question that came in, someone, let me go back, scroll back up here, and it was Sharon. She says, how do you turn a battleship? Okay, so I'm guessing that, and she says, and a culture of complacency. So it's this idea that you know, what can one person do when I guess she's feeling overwhelmed. Sharon, if you'd like to, you can hit your one key and I'll be able to find you on my screen here a lot faster if you'd like to get this. But what about this turning the battleship thing? You know, one person in a small person in a large organization.
Well, you know, I think it happens all the time. I think you see in GE, for example, the switch from Jack Welch to Jeff Immelt, you see a completely, this is a monstrous company, and yet it's entirely a different company today than it was when he was running it. Or John Brown, who was the CEO of BP. I can tell you I worked very closely with BP during the time he was the CEO. This would never have happened if he had been the CEO, I can tell you that. There's a new CEO called Tony Hayward who's running it now, and I think it's a sign that there's a different leadership going on. So one person does have a lot of power. If we look at the other end of the organization, how does one small person at the very bottom of the organization make change? By being impressive and inspiring. I mean, if you're inspiring, you can get people to listen. One answer, let me just add one more point. Yeah. We quickly tend to blame the system. We say it's too big, it's just little me. And we have to say and have to be bold enough and courageous enough to admit it isn't them. It's me. I'm not impressive enough to get their attention.
And let me actually, Sharon, did you have a clarification on this point? You got the mic, Sharon.
I did. I guess my question is really focusing on not that there's only one of me or my place in the organization, but it's getting, I think Cotter's work touches on it too. How do you get a sense of urgency and the drive to change direction quickly enough given the demands of how expedient we need to adjust to market conditions?
It's a great question. Let me give you an answer which probably won't be satisfying, but it's the way I figured this out because I've asked the same question too. I'm a passionate skier. I live in the mountains and I ski. I teach leaders all over the world how to ski double black diamonds in one day. They say that's ridiculous. How can you change that fast? That's nonsense. I say I do it all the time. Come ski with me and you'll ski double black diamonds in one day. We do it all the time, and they're amazed, absolutely stunned when they're skiing off waterfalls and off cliffs and so on. And they say, okay, I believe you, so now how do we do that in the corporation? That's the way I've achieved this, by demonstrating through a visceral method, you know, which in my case is skiing, but in the summer it could be kayaking and mountain biking, doesn't matter. I mean, you pick your instrument, but whatever way it is, you have to have some way of convincing people that dramatic change can be done. If you told me that I could ski double black diamonds in one day and I'm non-believer and then I do it, then I say, okay, I get it. Now what is it you're trying to tell me? Because now you have credibility and I believe you.
Sharon, does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you. Great point.
Yeah, I will say this, Sharon and everyone else, is that in the constraints of a teleseminar that's this length, the nature of it is that we can't go into great depth. My intent with having Lance here is to get you excited, open the possibility, at least get you to go to his site and explore as to the offerings that he has. Look at how he works and the language that he's using. And if you feel interested, you know, you can get a book or not. This is an opening, a possibility. That's why we're here, is that this whole idea of inspiration has got to start somewhere. We've got to start the dialogue somewhere. And Lance is doing that. And I'm so grateful that you're here today, Lance, doing that. Okay, so Lance, I got someone here who's very skeptical. Let me, I'm not going to share her name here. She says, I don't agree or buy into what he's saying. His approach hold on just a second. The screen moves a little bit each time someone adds something. Okay, so his approach and perspective don't strike me as authentic, more about selling and marketing the next new wave. I got turned off when he dismissed performance planning, coaching, psychometrics, etc. There's too much evidence and personal experience that indicates otherwise. What is your response to someone who is in that place of skepticism?
Well, I won't take every one of those, but let me just deal with one of them, performance appraisal. I have yet to meet someone who says, I can't wait for my annual performance appraisal. It's so inspiring, and I love it, and whenever it happens. And I have yet to meet someone who says, I love the part of the year when I do performance appraisals one after another all day long. It's the best time of my year. Nobody says that. Nobody finds this inspiring or helpful. And there are, of course, exceptions where there are some brilliant leaders who figured out ways around the system. But generally speaking, what what we consider to be the base level of knowledge in this field isn't helpful right now. And you know, anyone who's living in another world is, I think, in cuckoo land, because I don't find anybody in the world that I live in that really embraces that. Coaching, just to take another one, is in life coaching and business coaching, it's the only field in coaching of any field where you can't measure the return. And if I've got a pitching coach or a swing coach or a voice coach or an acting coach, I'll know right away what the metric is that I'm looking for and how to measure the return and whether my investment is paying off. We don't do that in business, in leadership coaching and life coaching. And it's an amazing thing to me that we don't, and that we have all kinds of pseudo-certification going on with major organizations who won't let you into the industry unless you go through all kinds of hurdles, which, you know, is their system. But there are all kinds of brilliant teachers all over the world who are wonderful coaches who don't belong to those systems. It's just a funny feel to me.
Mm. So are you not discounting coaching. It sounds like what you're discounting is the type of coaching that isn't producing results.
Absolutely. I'm not discounting performance appraisals or assessment either. What I'm saying is that we have not got a good system yet for either of those two fields, and that we can actually build much stronger systems for coaching and for performance management than we have done in the past.
A performance appraisal system where people actually look forward to the process.
Exactly. And that they find it inspiring, and that it's a dialogue, not a judgment, and where they're able to grow. We call this attunement, because what we're actually doing is recalibrating the company's goals and the individual's goals so that they're aligned and therefore attuned, and it's a respectful, inspiring conversation.
Okay. So, Karen writes, when we've lost the bubble and things are in a slump, how do you recommend we get our dream and inspiration back? And Karen, I'm not sure, are you talking about personally or organizationally with your team? If you'd like to clarify that point, you can just hit your one key and I'll be able to find you fairly quickly on the on my screen here if you want to do that. So Lance, how do you get, if you're in a slump, and how do you get the dream back if you don't feel like you're able to dream anymore, or it's been so long since you felt inspired, where does a person start?
Well, I'm assuming that's at a personal level, and I think that part of it, as I've written about in the book, is that we need to identify our own end goal in life and the effect we're going to have on the world. We have a process that I've written about in the book about how to do that. But essentially, we want to tap into those things that really engage us, because that's what we have our passion around. So if for you passion is around poverty or abuse or environmental damage or violence or any of those things, you know, if you get excited about that, then that clearly is what your life should be dedicated to, and everything you're doing will help you move in that direction. I mean, my destiny, for example, is to help create a more loving and sustainable planet, because I think that in this world there's too much violence, and I don't think we can also sustain ourselves if we continue to environmentally if we continue to live the way we are. So my life is about creating a more loving and sustainable planet. So this conversation, for example, is part of my work to help create a more sustainable and loving planet. It's what guides my life. Now this inspires me. And as long as it's kind of like a bright light that is guiding me in my life, and if you have one of those, it will regenerate your inspiration.
Well, we've come to the top of the hour, and I'd like to wrap up with the pledge to inspire. And let me just plant this seed in everyone's I'd like to, after Lance tells us about this, the pledge concept that he's working on, I'd like to wrap up with, this is generally how I'd like to wrap up a call, is I'd like you to share what you got out of today's call. And ideally, you would hit your one key, I'd pass you the mic, and you can share with Lance and myself and the rest of the audience here what was positive for you, what was new and beneficial for you, or perhaps a reminder of something good that was out there. So I want to plant that seed now. And so Lance, tell us about the pledge.
I will. I just want to pick up on the point that was made earlier about it sounds like I'm selling books. Everybody, because I'm sort of stung by that a little bit, and I want everybody to know that I retired 30 years ago. I don't need to sell books. Long ago, the financial aspects of my life were taken care of. So I'm a happy boy in that sense. What I'm about is changing the world. And this book, I hope, is an important instrument to do that. So I would love your support for this book and bringing it to the world, because I think the world needs this message right now. Now, the pledge, I think that it's a simple thing that we need to do, all of us, which is to simply pledge to be more inspiring. What is not working at the moment? We say things to each other which are hurtful or wounding or not inspiring, and we could, I think, make much more progress if we pause for a moment. Robert Greenleaf had a wonderful way of saying this. He said, "Will what I'm about to say improve on the silence?" And I think that's a question that we can ask. And therefore, the pledge, it's inspirepledge.com. If you sign the pledge, it is simply a commitment that you are going to be more inspiring in every thought, word, and deed. No more than that. It doesn't cost any money. There's nothing, nobody's making anything out of this. It's simply that if we can start a movement where we are all committing to be more inspiring, we'll change the world. I mean, if we had 1 million people signing the pledge, we would change the world. So I invite people to go to inspirepledge.com and change the world.
I love it. And this is the part about being in community with others and standing up and saying, this is what I believe in. It's one thing to do it in the quiet of our own home or, in the car as we're driving, but it's another to assemble with a group of people, other like-minded people who are saying, this is important. This is how we can change the world, even as just something as simple as saying and expressing our voice. And so we can do that online. I love the use of technology. Well, okay, so let's do this. Hit your one key, and I'll pass you the mic, and you can share with Lance and the rest of the group here today, participants from all over the world here, about what did you get out of today's call? What was beneficial for you? What did you like about the message that Lance is sharing through that he shared today and what you hear in his book? And I'm going to pass you the mic. Let me scroll down here. I see a couple people. And Nathan in Florida. Go ahead, Nathan.
Thanks very much, Tom. Mike, thank you very much for your words. And I feel very encouraged today because I felt like a voice crying in the wilderness. And I felt when I brought up some of the things you mentioned, I was told that it was too feely touchy and it has no place in corporation. And thank you very much that you have confirmed and reaffirmed a lot of stuff that I've been going through the last few years. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
That was Nathan.
Oh, Nathan. Sorry.
Yeah,
thank
Nathan.
You, Nathan.
Yeah. That's one of the things I love about Lance's work is that large organizations are listening to the language and are associating with the language that he's using, like love. It's how often do we hear that? Let me pass the mic to David. David, you've got the mic. Go ahead.
Lance, I want to thank you for the area. And I was most impressed with just the wholeness of the message that you're involved in doing. I happen to work for a nonprofit who for 30 plus years have been working this particular, not with the same words, but the same concept of that to a very difficult audience. And I can tell you that it works. It doesn't work with every person, but it's been a great journey. So I congratulate you. I think it's going to be a good book, and I encourage those to kind of take a look at it. I plan on reading it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, David. And Heidi writes in and says, I believe that telling the truth is the root to the entire castle theory. That's the part that she connects with. She says, great speaker. Thanks for the encouraging words. So I think that that's the other piece about who you are. My experience of you, Lance, is that I leave conversations with you encouraged. In other words, my courage jumps up. I have more courage to step out there and, like Nathan was saying, to have, you know, share this type of language with people where it can seem too touchy-feely and nice, but where's the bottom line?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that we have so much power, and yet we feel we're powerless. But, you know, we think that the CEO has all the power and the leaders have the power. But if 5,000 people in a company all walked out tomorrow morning, how much power would the CEO have?
Right. Very little. And I think that this is also the piece about even outside of work. As I mentioned, my friend who just retired from teaching at a university is my message to him was that even though you don't have students coming into you into your classroom anymore, what you have is, you know, any of us have is the internet. I mean, we can begin to create change just sitting behind a computer. Not that that's a calling for everyone, but now it seems like, Lance, that it's an incredible time to be living and to the opportunities in front of us. Well, Lance, thank you again for your time here today, and thanks for everyone showing up. And again, Lance Secretan, you can find his work at secretan.com, S-E-C-R-E-T-A-N, and you can also go to the webpage where you signed up for this call today and find the links and to the book and Lance's website, and I'll also post a link to the Pledge to Inspire there, and I'll also be posting the recording if you would like to pass this on to any of your friends or colleagues. It should be posted within the next 48 hours. So, Lance, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Thanks to everybody for sharing your time, and I know it's a very busy day, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Be looking for other opportunities to come on to calls at the IATF with other thought leaders, and I'm sure we're going to have Lance back another time. We can never get enough of his message. At least I can. I will say that. So thanks again, everybody. I look forward to talking with you soon. Bye-bye.